better. Hey, welcome to the June 4th edition of the Linux Link Tech Show.
Better late than never.
That's it, episode 86. Great episode. It's
lots
monumental.
Of fun. Lots of things to
because
talk
it's
about.
The 86th.
Yeah, no guests tonight.
No stinking guests.
And no stinking Link. Again. It's like he wanted to do this damn show 2 years ago, and now he never shows up anymore. It's like he's gone. The Linux Link absent Link show. Linux Link minus Link show. How about that, huh?
The Linux Allen tech show.
The Linux Allen. Yeah, the Linux Allen tech show. Oh, yeah. All right. Hey, we got a promo to play this week.
Finally.
Cool.
It's been a few weeks, right?
That's right.
Crack it
we
up,
actually
dude.
Do. Coming from a good friend of ours, Droops from Infonomicon. Give it a second. Give it a second.
Hey, everybody in Tech Show Land. This is Droops from Infonomicon Radio, and I am hooked on the Linux Link Tech Show. Now, when I say hooked, I don't just mean regular old hooked. I mean snagged in the mouth, hauled in the boat, thrown in the cooler, taken back home, filleted, put on ice, and stuffed in the deep freeze. Kind of hooked. I'm sure y'all heard the one with Richard Stallman. That was really, really awesome. It's one of the best ones so far. Pat Link and the rest of the crew do an awesome job with this show. They always make it fun, they always make it interesting, and they always make it what's playing on my iPod.
About that, he called out Pat.
First one, baby.
Yeah, and Link, and screw Alan and me.
Alan is still number one on the video downloads.
That's it.
Everybody wants to see Alan.
Yeah, for some reason I'm going to want to see it eventually because I have no clue what it was. I forget what we recorded.
Hey, what are you going to do?
Download it and watch it.
Yeah, they're out there. That's what it's there for, Alan.
Oh, I know. I just have to, like...
You probably don't even have Theora support on your video players, do you?
Not at the moment,
the truth comes out.
That's why I said I got to... Well, I know, but I got to install that. I don't install that stuff.
Look at that. No one's going to hear you when you turned away from the microphone looking at Pat talking.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm used to talking to, like, the back of people, so...
Look at Link's back.
I'm like, yo, I'm in the Link chair tonight.
Yeah, we got a jam-packed show tonight. We got some good stuff. Kernel compiling. Talking about package management systems versus rolling your own and an amalgamation of the two, and some tips on doing that. And also Linux screen recording with VNC utilities we'll be talking about. And the interesting thing is I put all this together. They all roll into one another, which I found quite cool. And hopefully I'll be able to make you guys feel it was cool how they all actually roll into one another. And some examples. And this week we actually have show notes I put together.
Ooh.
And what would have been even nicer is if I didn't lose my paper copy of the notes I had. I took them. Wait, maybe this is them right here.
A piece of toilet paper with the notes.
Here they are right here, I think. Yep, this is...
that crumbled up one that was underneath the laptop.
Piece of paper. Yes, we will have show notes posted with all the links and information
cool.
about what we'll be talking about
tonight.
You guys,
we used to do that way back in the beginning, right? And it kind of died out.
Yep. Died out hard.
So now I just do the index, which is okay. People looking for certain things on certain episodes.
They can right. find it. And I don't know if you have stuff, because you brought over a piece of paper there.
Well, the only thing I wanted to talk about was the top five downloads. If you want, I can go through it right now before we get rolling.
We'll come back to that in a minute.
Okay.
So we're going to hit hate mail first.
All right.
Ooh, everybody loves hate mail. Hate mail. All right. What hate mail did we get in the past week?
We have to come up with music for hate mail.
Me hate you.
Yes, we did. Oh, I know. I got something perfect for the hate mail.
You guys suck. Get a life.
We got something perfect. Here's our hate mail.
Crap. Apple crap.
Yep.
Now you're going to get an email saying, why do you keep playing the children? We don't want to hear your kids. Yeah, I'm sure they're cute.
Gotcha. All right.
Get those little brats out of here.
Okay, this came in. Actually, was it? It was roughly soon after we put out last
week. We have
week's
a request
show.
To Skype link in. That's right up now? The link. He's got to like Skype us.
Yeah, we'll get to him in just a
feel
minute.
Like talking to us.
Okay, guys, why do you waste your listeners' time with some of your banter? The Star Wars segment was empty bandwidth, not funny, and like, who cares? None of you are qualified movie or sci-fi critics. And even if you were, the tech show is not the venue for it. And even if it is, not for five whole totally wasted minutes. All right. Now, here's a. We get mixed results, mixed bag results.
Some people like it,
some people like
it.
The idle banter, some people don't. But hey, it's great that you have your opinion. After some 80 shows, I can't figure out why three self-professed engineers can't get the audio to work so that all of you speak at the same volume and that one of you does not sound like he's in the middle of the Lincoln Tunnel speaking with marshmallows in his
that
mouth.
That sounds like me.
That must be you, Pat.
Yeah,
how
so.
About listening to your own show every once in a while?
I know I have marble mouth.
The equivalent in software development is called testing. And I, you know, I listen to every episode, and I don't know what the hell happened last week.
Last week was
but
the worst one, man.
The MP3 file was atrocious. What we pulled in off of there was atrocious. The AUG file was great.
Yeah, it's crystal clear.
It was beautiful, but the MP3 was atrocious. And I thought about encoding MP3 off of what I made the AUG from, because I keep the wave around for about a week until I'm like, I don't need it anymore. But then it was like, you know, 3 days later, and but it's true. I don't know why we can't get it together with this audio for some reason. Now
we're working on
it. There's a misconception here, and maybe, I don't know, maybe one of you guys said something, because if they're obviously saying three self-professed engineers, it doesn't include me. I'm not an audio engineer at all in any way, shape, or form.
I'm a computer programmer who used to be in a band. That's my
experience. We are seeking outside help, I know, because there was a guy who wrote into us.
The other thing is, you know, we have absolutely no outboard gear. We're going through this, you know, little tiny mixer, you know, directly into the computer. I mean,
well, and the other thing is, we set up 5 minutes before we go to play. I mean, we did our audio checks here for like the last half an hour or so, and we were still doing them when we should have been started.
Well, hopefully today's a little better.
Hopefully we'll be a little bit better today. As long as we don't swallow the microphones and talk like normal human beings,
right.
I think we'll be all right.
But it gets to the point now. I mean, we're about a month and a half into crappy audio issues. We're going to definitely get together outside of the show times to fix these problems. So we do acknowledge that it's gone on longer than it should have. And hopefully this show will be a step in the right direction.
Shame.
Shame.
Shame
on
Shame.
Us. Okay. He brings up an interesting point. How about putting the show on tape and editing it? Live is good, but overrated, because the vast majority of folks are listening hours or days after the end of the show. So while it's live to you, it is not to us. And that, you know, that's an interesting point. If we were to go back and instead of putting the show out, the live version out right away, right afterwards, we might be able to fix some of the audio issues in post-production.
It would take all the fun out of doing a show.
How many days?
We'd still be doing it live, but in order to go through and edit the show, I don't know. I mean, that's a lot of work and a lot of time.
It's going to end up being a lot of work probably on your part.
Yeah, on my part.
Because you're the one's going to end up doing it.
And, man, I would like to say I'd have it out that night, but no way. Maybe 2-3 days if I'm lucky.
Yeah, at least 3 days.
It depends on what's going on. So, I mean, it's, you know, tell us. Do you want us to hold off on releasing
the whole live show? Thing, I think that's what really differentiates us between, you know, all the other shows. The only show that used to do a live, you know, show was the old Linux show. That's it. Everybody
right.
else is pre-recorded.
Right.
I kind of like the live thing. It's like, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, you know.
Right. But, I mean, we could still capture. I mean, we'd still be doing it live. The only thing we'd be doing is cleaning it up, taking out some of the pauses and whatever. I don't know. It's just a thought. He brought it up. You know, this is his third or fourth email to us, and he brings up a lot of good points, I think. He's pretty critical, and he gives us something to think about. He likes our interviews. He thinks we're getting better on the interviews. I still think our interviews kind of suck, but that's me. He asked a question if we were ever interested in if has anybody approached us with syndication, if we're interested in any syndication. Again, no, nobody that I know of has approached us with syndication, and I'm not sure that we are at this point interested in syndication. audio problems alone.
I'd be happy if people donate some equipment.
Yeah.
Sounds a compressor limiter, you know.
So, brought up some interesting points. If anybody out there, you know, feels the way that he does, please, you know, let us know. Or if you have any, you know, if you think you disagree with him, you like the idle banner. I think we can all agree that the audio sucks.
Lately.
But we're...
Although everyone on the chat has said today so far that it sounds good on the chat, so...
But you know what? It's not the live is all right. It's either the MP3 or the AUG bites ass for some reason.
The AUG has been good lately, though.
Right. But now I suspect that hopefully the MP3 will be good, and this week the AUG is going to be terrible because it's too low. We're going to have to boost
crank it up a
little bit. Yeah, boost it in the post-production, the minimal post-production that we do. So we're definitely looking into that. So thank you very much for that. And we have from Armand Lynch comments about the Little Rascals for those of us who there was a mention last week. Did you guys read that email?
Yeah, I saw that one. I don't have it here, but
he said, let me give you a little insight into the black psyche when it comes to things like the Little Rascals. It's all about image. What black folk don't like about those images is that they feel that white folk think that the caricatures of black folk in those images are an accurate representation of the whole black community. That's it. As a minority, you feel that you live in the world of Archie Bunkers, another stereotype. You have to watch your step and control your image. Good point. So that's, you know, the reasoning behind why, who was it, Bill Cosby, I think it was, bought up the rights to the Little Rascals.
I think that's lame. I still think it's lame.
I you know what? You might think it's lame, but I kind of I know exactly what he's talking about. But maybe later on, 20 more years down the line,
I don't know, man.
Society won't be that.
My parents always told me treat other people like you look how you like to be treated, and I think that's good code to live by. You know, you don't prejudge people. You know, you treat them based on their actions.
Yeah, there's a lot of assholes out there too.
Well, there's assholes everywhere. You can't avoid.
And they blow it for the rest of us. I think that's about it on our hate mail.
That wasn't too hateful.
No,
these headphones are annoying.
Yeah, do they hurt your ears?
Yeah, it's like...
Just like pressure on your ears?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've decided to go to the closed headphones as opposed to the open little things I was wearing. I think I'm going to go back to the other ones, though.
Really?
These things... I mean, besides my ears sweating like pigs right now. On it, it's just, I guess it's probably because I haven't worn closed type headphones in like 20 some odd years.
I don't know. The whole thing with those earbuds is, man, it's always very tinny. It always sounds crappy. They never stay in your ear properly.
Oh, well, no, I don't wear the earbuds. I wear the...
The open-ended ones?
Yeah, the open, I don't know what you call them. You've seen what I wear, so.
They're headphones.
Here's an email regarding our audio last week. From Robert. Says, hi, I'm a long-time listener to LLTS, and I wanted to let you know that I really like your show. However, there's something I need to let you know. You really need to lower the gain into your encoder. The MP3 stream sounds like the audio signal level is too high, thus creating distorted audio from the MP3. All you need to do is just lower the level going into your encoder just a notch or two, and that will definitely clean your audio up. And that is exactly what we were doing.
That's what we were trying to do tonight.
Prior to the show. And one of the issues, what it seems like is we fixed the problem on one piece going into the MP3 encoder, but now we have it, the issue on the other piece. We can, I don't know. We're looking into it. Here's a request from Jeff. Doesn't say where he's from. Jeff says, hello, TLLTS. I think that a short synopsis in the RSS feed, although longer than GNU Linux and open source commentary, would be a good thing. When I'm referencing a podcast with someone and it is about a previous show, I have to download and play the shows, at least the first part, to make sure that I'm sending a link to the correct podcast. Yes, I know it'll take more time, but it would need to cover every subtopic and non sequitur, just a guess in the major subtopics. And I never really, you know, thought about this. When I post on the BinRev RSS feed and hackermedia.net, I usually include a synopsis. But when I do it with our own RSS feeds for the podcasting,
we never do that.
You know, I never do it because I'm so used to using Bashpotter, and I never see anything, you know, any other information other than it just grabs a file and downloads them. So, yeah.
It's good for, like, people who use blog lines.
I'll definitely.
Because it does, you know, cause you only see the one line there when we do blog lines.
Yeah, I try to put it in the ID3 tags.
You usually have
both of them.
The guests, right, in there?
In the ID3 tags, yeah. Yes, I do. But not in the RSS. The RSS feed, it's just usually been the episode. But I will add that extra information into the RSS feed. It's not that difficult. And if it makes our listeners happy,
what the hell?
At least we can fix that right away.
What the hell?
That's it. Now, Pat, we're also looking into another voice over IP solution. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I don't want to go too much into detail. Basically, a company is going to be sending us some equipment, and it looks like we're going to be setting up an Asterisk server, and we're going to have to get a provider. I've got a pretty good idea who we're going to use for the provider. I think we'll go into more detail once we get everything all set up and up and running, and we might be able to kiss Skype goodbye and actually call people on a telephone with really good sound quality. So we're going to take the dip into Asterisk. I know, Alan, you've done a little bit of Asterisk, right?
I've played around with it, but like, not since I got the new machine. I have to try it with the new machine when it will actually work.
Like, the piece of equipment.
The 300 megahertz Pentium that I was using it on, whereas it did work, it didn't work very well.
The piece of equipment that we're getting is a gateway analog converter. So you can actually plug a regular phone into it, but it can also handle it in the digital interface. And it supposedly it handles a lot more of what's required for Asterisk. You know, you recommended a really cheapy card, you know, from that eBay.
Well, the cheapy card was not for all that card did was interface your regular phone line to Asterisk.
Okay.
On it. It wasn't actually for putting phones on the Asterisk. At that point, all of your phones would be soft phones unless you had Ethernet-ready phones. All that card was just to get you a POTS line into an Asterisk box. That was all that was for. If you're going to use a regular voice over IP application on it, you want to get like a BroadVox or someplace like that.
Yeah, we're getting. I believe it's a Sephora 3000.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you would need one of those even if you had just the card and you were going over a regular POTS line on. You would still need one of those to have a regular phone hooked up to an Asterisk server.
So we're going to try.
Yeah, that. What he said.
Hey, what's happening, Link?
How you doing, guys?
Good.
Hey. You're sounding okay.
And I guess we're sounding okay, too, yes?
Yeah, you are. You sound a little loud on my end, but I can turn that down over here.
You sound fine.
Yeah, well, we sounded muffled. Somehow we just couldn't get it all working properly. Turn it up in one place, it goes down in another. It's like a seesaw effect. Turn it up one place, it's too loud. Turn it down, you can't hear it. Oh. But we're getting there.
We'll get there.
We're getting
Nothing
there.
Nothing wrong with that.
And you, nice of you to join us via Skype.
Nice of you to finally let me join you.
What's your excuse, Frank?
I was ready like, about 20 minutes ago.
Okay.
I tried to get in. You guys didn't have Skype up or something. You didn't show up, so.
No, we had it down. We were trying to get all this stuff coordinated and and get through, the recordings and all that other crap that goes on. Because you're not here and,
cool.
And Alan messed everything up again.
Right, well, we know what happens every time I'm not there. You guys have all those problems, so that's why they call it the Linux Link Tech Show, right?
That's
not the Linux Alan Tech Show. Or the Linux Dan Tech Show.
Not the Linux Alan Tech Show, right?
Anything you'd like to start off with before we launch into our topics for tonight?
I can explain where I was. I was at my daughter had a Spanish culture night for her school. So I went to, I had to like do the whole thing where I cooked Spanish chicken and rice. I couldn't even tell you what the Spanish name is, but it's Spanish chicken and rice. And I went there, and what did I learn tonight? I learned how to say hola. You guys should be proud of me.
Was that Spanish chicken and rice like Jose made?
No, man, that was good stuff.
That was Puerto Rican stuff.
Jose's was good stuff, man. This was, I guess, like Spanish chicken and rice. It's a staple dish from Spain.
Paella?
Actually, I think. You got me. Yeah, you would know better than I would, Pat.
Yeah, my mom's from Spain. Been there a bunch of times, so I'm pretty familiar with all that food. It's good stuff, man. Lots of wine, lots of ham, lots of fish.
But, yeah, basically, so, I did that, and I watched the kids, and I had a good time watching them do their little thing. And they had a little, it was Spanish culture night, but they had little sections roped off that were from different Spanish countries like Peru and Spain and Mexico and Puerto Rico and stuff like that. It was pretty cool. Everybody should take some time out to go hang out with their kids once in a while. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Dan, stop compiling. Take your kids out.
Oh, we're getting there. We'll get to the... compiling it.
What are you compiling this time, Dan?
I'm not compiling anything, but I did compile my kernel about 6 times before the show today.
Why would that be? You're doing Debian now, right?
Yes, I am doing Debian. And I'll explain exactly why, because I was testing some stuff out. So I had, not only did I put the notes together, but I also tested a lot of stuff I talked about. I will be talking about. Unless I already did and slipped into a little Twilight Zone, and now I can go home.
Special.
But I'm already here.
You're already home, though.
Oh. All right, so if you guys don't have any other further... why don't you go ahead with your...
Want me to do the top five?
Go ahead. You do your top five.
Well, I looked back at some of the statistics from our previous episodes.
Shouldn't there be music for this?
I guess we could.
Top five music.
We don't have to. The top five most downloaded episodes for this year's episodes. Ready? Here we go. At number five, Windows Crash Radio. That was a fan favorite. Pretty recent.
That's your music.
Thank you. Number four.
That was a lot of fun, too, except for all the people that thought that we were really like changing venues or something like that.
Number four was our interview with Warren Woodford, the founder of Mepis. Number three was our interview with Doc Searles. Number two was our interview with Richard Stallman.
And behind door number one?
And number one was our interview with Matt Friedman. Now, that was just for this year, the five all-time episodes. Number five, Richard M. Stallman. Number four, episode 54.
Episode one.
Which was what?
I don't know. It was just a general, regular old episode.
Crap. Apple crap.
That's what it was.
That's what the little girls think.
It was a good regular old episode.
It was a show on the clap.
Number three was episode 53. Number two was Matt Friedman. And the number one all-time episode was episode 52.
Which one was the Conan show?
Nah, that was early. Conan show was like...
That was like episode
number eight,
15
think,
or something.
8 or 10, something like that.
The Conan show.
Now, as far
did
as
the Conan show make any list? That's
no,
what
it
I wanted.
No, it didn't. Now, our growth has been pretty tremendous. Our downloads are up 300% since October of 2004, and our hits are up 400% since October of 2004. So we're growing.
You have way too much time on your hands, don't you?
No kidding.
Actually, I was really busy today, but I just spent a few minutes while I was eating my lunch and started adding things up, and there you go.
Yeah, it's because you get to do that because you're an executive.
Oh yeah, right.
That's what it is. It's only the suits that have that kind of.
I don't
free
wear
time
a suit, my
hands,
friend.
Man.
No, I don't wear a suit.
So now we should expect to see those downloads go down as our audio quality.
They're gonna plummet.
Down.
They're actually going up every.
No, they keep tuning in to hear if it gets any better.
If it gets any better,
you know?
Yeah.
So right. good things to come in the future, I think.
We only hope. We only hope. What time is it? Keep an eye on the time. Oh, it's 9 o'clock. We started late. Yeah, I got a date.
21:08.
So. Let's get rolling right into kernels, baby. Kernels, kernels, kernels. Kernel. And we can talk about kernel because it's Linux. Linux is the kernel. So you don't refer to it as GNU, Linux, because we're just talking about
it's Linux.
The kernel. Linux kernel. Ah. Every distribution is built around the Linux kernel. You can't have Linux without the Linux kernel. Now, the kernel is designed to be a modular kernel, which means that you have just the base kernel itself, and you can load modules in and out of it. But you could also build a monolithic kernel, which would be having everything it needs inside the kernel and not having to load any drivers or modules, which are what drivers are, into the kernel after it's already been up and running.
I got one little question, Dan. Everybody talks about, you know, being specific about kernel compiling, only using the modules that you need. Does it really make that much of a difference if you have a huge kernel or, you know...
Well, we're going to get into that, Pat, and hopefully I will answer
your question in
a few minutes. Now, the kernel that comes with your distribution is not necessarily the same kernel that you're going to pull down at kernel.org, which is the main source for the Linux kernel. Kernel.org, you're going to find the vanilla Linux kernel. You'll also find links off of there to individual developers and their patches, like Alan Cox has his own patches, and everything that you can add to the kernel, which are not necessarily in the current stable kernel, but are maybe in the unstable, in the testing and developmental kernels, or they might not even be in those at all, some of those patches that you can get. Now, the kernel that you get with your distribution, for instance, in Debian, Red Hat, SUSE, those kernels will also have extra patches added to them. Larger distributions usually have a kernel development team that works into adding patches. They might add some of those patches, like the Alan Cox patches or whatever, that you can get off of the stable tree over on kernel.org. They also add their own stuff in there to keep up with security and patching the kernel that way. So you're not getting necessarily the vanilla kernel. One of the exceptions to this is Slackware. Slackware comes with just a plain vanilla kernel. No extra patches, just what you get from kernel.org. So that being said, the question might be,
It should be.
If you want to compile your kernel, what do you do? Do you get your kernel from the distribution, or do you get a vanilla kernel if you want the latest kernel? And again, it's gonna be pretty much up to you. You have to be, generally speaking, you could probably get away with using a vanilla kernel on most any distribution.
Unless it's something specific.
Well, even if it is, I mean, unless you have some oddball hardware that's not supported and that distribution decided to include in the kernel. For instance, an example might be the Linux WLAN-NG drivers. Okay, if your distribution decided to include those drivers in with the kernel, you're not going to get those drivers from the standard vanilla kernel. You would have to go out, get the kernel, vanilla kernel, download it, install it, and then go get the Linux WLAN-NG drivers and install those separately. It's possible that your distribution might have taken care of that for you. And a lot of distributions like Ubuntu, Debian, that when you actually pull those drivers down, it's a separate package. So they already have it compiled for their specific kernel. And I'll be talking about, you know, particularly those type of issues later on with regards to when you have a kernel that you've built, how do you get third-party drivers or modules into it? What do you actually need to do? We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Okay, so choice is yours. Do you get the kernel from your distribution and recompile it, or do you get a plain vanilla kernel from kernel.org? If you're using Slackware, it really doesn't matter. If you want to keep up with the latest and greatest, you can pull it down off them because it is a vanilla kernel to begin with. Anyway, why would you want to recompile your kernel? Well, in this day and age, one of the biggest debates used to be, should you have your drivers compiled into the kernel or separate as modules? And the general consensus seems to be it really doesn't matter anymore. It used to be, well, if you don't have them compiled into the kernel, it's not going to take up as much space. The kernel won't take up as much space if you haven't compiled as modules. Therefore, you can have a smaller kernel. It could fit on a floppy disk. It could be fit on, you know, an installation disk a lot easier. And then you would have the modules outside of it that could be loaded in. But then the question is, well, if you're having to load in extra modules, is that going to take up more system resources? Machines these days, it really doesn't matter. The performance that you would gain... What?
Can you just hear all the hate mail we're going to get from the Gen 2 people on this one?
Right. Well, generally speaking, the performance difference between having it compiled in or compiled as a module doesn't seem to be take a hit from more recent systems.
No, not on a two gigahertz machine or better. It's really negligible.
Yes, it is. It is negligible, and it's not going to take up much more system resources on a powerhouse machine. Now, if you're trying to build a really slim system, for instance, if you're using like an embedded device
right.
or an older system,
it's
it might
specific.
Be advantageous yep. to compile the what you want into the kernel. When I first started compiling kernels, it must have been about a year and a half after I began using Linux. Probably wasn't even that long.
And every day since.
Yeah, and every day since. The general consensus was what you'd want to do is compile the hardware for your system that you absolutely need
right.
into the kernel. For instance, they recommended compiling in your network card. You'd want to compile in your chipset for your motherboard, any motherboard chipsets. Of course, PCI support, ISA support, all that stuff. You'd want to compile in there. Drivers for whatever, if you're using SCSI or your IDE controller, you'd want to compile into the kernel. Now, you don't absolutely have to compile those into the kernel, but it is recommended, particularly for the stuff that your system requires to boot. Your chipsets, your controllers, your drive controllers should kind of be compiled into the kernel. And you don't have to, and we'll talk about what you would have to do if you didn't compile them into your kernel and some of the pitfalls that you're going to have in a minute. But generally speaking, modules or monolithic kernel, it's up to you. What you'd want to do, though, if you're really interested in it, tailoring a kernel specifically for your system, and one of the reasons why you would recompile is you'd want to get rid of all that stuff that you're not going to use. For instance, chances are if you're not a ham radio operator, you don't need the ham radio support in your kernel.
Yeah.
If you don't have an ISDN line, you don't need ISDN in your kernel.
Or dial-up if you don't have dial-up.
Right. PPP, chances are if you already have DSL, you're never going to use point-to-point protocol on your system or your workstation right there. All right. Now, with the newer kernels, of course, you can go back and compile that due to compile process just a module for most of the modules and get away with it successfully. Whereas if you wanted to re-enable PPP support, you might be able to get away with just putting it as a module. And we'll touch on that when we're talking about the compiling process. But generally speaking, compiling a kernel lets you tailor it for your system. A lot of kernels these days might come specifically for 686 machine, generic 686. I think Slackware is still at 486. Used to be
486,
Intel
yeah.
386. So
you
but might want
to know what most of the user land stuff right now is still compiled under i486.
Right. So if you really
so
want,
even if you have a kernel compiled under i686, it's still using all the user land programs at the i486 level. Most people don't do a make world when they compile their kernel too, you know.
Right. So you'd want to tailor it. If you want to tailor kernel more for your system, that's one of the reasons to compile. Of course, another reason is to get support that might not be existing in the current kernel you're using. For instance, a couple years ago, I had myself a Palm Tungsten T5, and the latest kernel didn't have support for it, but I'd have to manually go in and hack the driver for the tungsten device so that it would be recognized. There's an instance where I had to not only compile my own kernel, but also hack the sources to get it to work until a stable kernel or a developmental kernel came out with that patch already put in place. So
I think the biggest one why people compile kernels is
because it's cool.
FireWire is the big one nowadays.
Right, and most most of the distributions that I've been using lately, the Slackware and the Debian, have already had FireWire support. You didn't have that experience?
Mepis didn't like my FireWire.
Didn't like it?
No, I had to go and recompile the kernel.
Now, did you compile FireWire into the kernel or as a module?
Module.
Okay. Because I'm trying to remember. I forget what I did. I think I might have compiled mine into the kernel last time I did it. Some stuff I will compile right into it. You were going to say something?
No.
Okay. So now the choice is getting a kernel from your distribution or getting a vanilla kernel. I'm going to talk specifically between Slackware and Debian with regards to this information. If you're using SUSE, Red Hat, it'll apply to you. Just fill in the blanks where you see fit. Now, I've used Slackware for a good five, six years and compiling my own kernels on there. And I've never had a problem with compiling the latest kernel. I usually keep up on the latest stable. When 2.6 came out, I started 2.6 right away. Never had a problem. But you need to be aware of there's if you're going from major versions of a kernel from like 2.4 to 2.6, you're going to need the right module utilities to be able to compile a 2.6 kernel. So if you have a newer version of a distribution, Red Hat, SUSE, something that came out within the past 6 months, it's going to be ready for a 2.6 kernel if you're not already using it. If you don't have a newer distribution, maybe you're at Red Hat 7. What is Red Hat at 9 now?
9.
Red Hat 8. Some of the older distributions, if you're still using Debian Woody, you might want to double check. Did you have the proper module utilities to go to the 2.6 kernel series? You can go over to the kernel compiling how-to. Chances are it's on your distribution to begin with. There'll be information and links in the notes about where you can pull this, whether your system is ready for a 2.6 kernel if you're just using a 2.4 right now. But like I said, most likely if you're using a modern distribution the past couple of months, you should have no problem going to 2.6 if you're not already there. Now, on the Slackware side again, just go to kernel.org, download the latest kernel. If you're running, I forget what version, I think it's 2.6.9 is what Slackware 10.1 came with. Could be wrong, it could be 2.6.8. Link, do you know what it is offhand?
Okay. No, I'm not sure.
All right. You have two choices. You can download the full, like the latest one is 2.6.11.10. You could download that image right there of that source tarball, pull that down, it's like 30 or 40 megs in size. Or you can get the patches. Now, patches are incremental. So if you're going from 2.6 to 2.6, 2.6.9 to 2.6.10, or 2.6.11 actually, you'd have to get the patch for 2.6.10. Then from 2.6.10, you'd have to get the patch to 2.6.11. And you'll also need to get the patch to 2.6.10.11. Now, there's release candidates in between our minor releases and the 2.6.11 series. There's 1 through 10 right now. Unlike patching from like 2.6.9 to 2.6.10, where you just get the patch, and then 2.6.10 to 2.6.11, you have to get a patch for that. When you have those minor releases, you could just get the 2.6.10. Because if you try and patch from 2.6.11.1 to 2 to 3, 3 is going to have all the patches from .1 and 2 in it. So you don't want to get those incremental, those smaller sub-level incremental patches.
Because a lot of people just find it easier just to download the whole source.
Yeah, well, there's pros and cons with doing that. If you download the whole source, okay?
Takes up more space.
You're going to have to recompile the whole thing anyhow. All right, it takes up more space. You'll have to, you can carry over your .config file from the old one and just run make new config. If you just get the patches, patches are like 1 to 3 megs in size most of the time. It's a lot faster to download those. Patch your current sources, and you're good to go. Now, contrary to the downloading a vanilla kernel and patching it from there, the other side is your distribution. may provide a patch, like a Debian package patch. But what I did with mine is, if you go over to Debian's site and you start looking, you know, you search through the packages for the kernel sources, you can grab the current kernel sources and drop those down onto your machine. And the current version of the kernel that I was running when I installed Sarge over there was 2.6.8. And I downloaded vanilla 2.6.11.10, compiled that. Now, 2.6.11.10 is available from Debian under the testing, or I'm sorry, under unstable. But you can get the sources, which has all the Debian patches already rolled into the 2.6.11.10 kernel. So what you get when you download that source, kernel source from Debian, is you get not only the updates to the 2.6.10.11, but you also get the Debian contributions to that. And that's as simple as installing that package, and then you get a tarball in your USR source directory, which is that kernel source. You extract that, and you can compile away all you want. It's pretty easy to do. Now, if you're moving from like 2.6.9 to 2.6.11, what you'd want to do, if you're going to keep your old configuration and just move up to, you know, when you get the new one, first thing you'd want to do is run make old config. That'll go through your old configuration. That is, make if you patched it or you copied over your .config file. And it would ask you, do you want to add whatever changes were in? Like if there was a new support for new hardware in there, it says, do you want to add that? Do you want to add it into the kernel, compile it into the kernel, or compile it as a module? It's a pretty simple step-by-step process. It'll walk you through everything that's changed from your old config to your new config, and you'll be right up and ready to go. So if you're moving and you've already compiled your kernel in the past, you might have to do is just run make old config, and you look through there, and it's probably stuff that you're not interested in or you're interested in getting. You just say you want it as a module or into the kernel, and you're good to go. Then you can start compiling the kernel. But if not, you know, you want to actually, this might be your first time or whatever, sitting down to configure this particular kernel for your system, or you want to change some stuff, you have a couple other options. All right, there's four different configs that you can run, not including make old config. There is, if you're running X, you have a choice between make X config, which is a Qt based menu system. It's a nice little layout. There's make G config, which is GTK config. If you're not running X, or you're doing this remotely, or you don't want to use an X, you know, be an X when you're compiling your kernel, you can use make menu config, which uses ncurses.
That's what I use.
Yeah, it's pretty smooth. It's easily laid out. The other one, the one that's horrible, and I've done this already on a 486, which I couldn't get ncurses on there, let alone have X at all, is make config, which will walk you through line by line.
It's tedious, man.
Everything. And that's a lot that you actually have to walk through. And it's essentially just like make old config.
Right.
But instead of just asking you, you know, this is what changed in between there.
You go through every step.
You go through every step.
Every single menu.
So if you mess up, I don't think you can go back.
You got to start over.
Yeah, you got to start all the way over. Now, if you're really adventurous, and although they put warnings on there, and they say, oh, be very careful, you know, don't edit the file. You can edit the config file by hand if you know
what
you are doing.
Yeah.
If you're making a simple change, instead of having to fire all that stuff up, you probably get away with it. But you need to be careful, because sometimes when you...
There's dependencies.
When you enable a feature in the kernel in one place, it makes this change in another place. And if you just go in there and add some stuff or make changes, you might not get what you expected at the end.
It's not advisable.
Not advisable at all. So, you know, stick with those four utilities right there. No matter what kind of system you have, you're bound to be able to compile a kernel with ease, starting off with that. Now, when you're done configuring what you want, again, the recommendation is you compile the stuff that you need to boot your system, your chipset, your motherboard chipset, your controllers, hard drives, SCSI controllers, whatever. And in some cases, it might not be possible, or it might not work properly if you compile some SCSI controllers in there. You might not get exactly what you need to boot. And in those cases where you have to compile it as a module, We're going to talk about that after the kernel. What you would have to do is make an initialized RAM disk, initialization RAM disk, which was initrd, make an initrd file. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But at the point when you're done with configuring the kernel for the way you want it, what you then do, okay, two different steps. If you are running a version 2.4 kernel, you have to run make depend. You no longer have to do that with the 2.6 series. Now, the next debate comes in is, do you run make MR proper? What does make MR proper do? What it actually does is it cleans out the kernel sources, gets rid of all the object files, gets rid of all the compile, anything that was compiled. It puts it into a clean, pristine state.
So when you go from 2.4 to 2.6, you definitely need to run...
Well, when you go from 2.4 to 2.6, you're going two different... You can't go from... You can't go patch a 2.4 kernel to 2.6.
No.
You can't take your config file from 2.4 to 2.6.
That's why people had a problem going from 2.4 to 2.6 when the first 2.6 first came out.
Right, you don't want to take your config. You would want to build... You know, you'd have to build it from the ground up on a 2.6. All right? And that, of course, you know, the choice is, do you include everything in as a module, or do you compile certain stuff in? But that's up to you again. Depends on your unique situation.
We all had fun with 2.6.0 when it first came
right
out.
Right. So the general consensus is, if you move from like 2.6.8 to 2.6.10, you might want to run make MR proper. I have never had to run make MR proper at all. I've never had a problem. I've always had successful compiles. So my philosophy on that is, if you try and compile it and it bombs and it's not working for you, you know, take a look at what the problem is. If it's something like, I've had instances where it bombed out on NFS write support. Okay, so I don't run any Windows boxes here. So I don't, not, I'm sorry, NTFS write support. I don't know why I left it in there. I thought maybe one day I'll be coming across there'll be a magical Windows XP box in here, and I'll want to mount a Windows NTFS share on my Linux box or something. Somehow, I don't know how it would have gotten in here, but maybe one day. Well, that day has never come. So when I got the error on that, I said to myself, this is bull crap. I'm going to just get rid of it out of I don't need it.
You know,
it's senseless. I don't need it. Gone. And that took care of the error. But if you're getting an error, it won't let you compile, try going with the make MR proper and then recompiling, you know, make. What I usually do is a make BZ image, which creates a kernel image called BZ image in your architecture directory under the boot, subdirectory under your architecture. And once I do that, the next step would be make modules. It's going to go through the whole thing of making the modules. Now, on the 2.6, they say in some cases, if you go back in and want to enable a module, something that you didn't have in there as a module before, you can sometimes get away with just going in, getting out, instead of having to rebuild your whole kernel, just make the module. Again, that's one of those things. I've done it successfully, and I've not had problems with doing that, but you have to be careful. You got to test that out. If it doesn't work for you, you got to go through the process of rebuilding, you know, just recompile your kernel, recompile the modules, and reinstall them. Now, you might say to yourself, okay, so if I want to make a little change to my kernel, I want to test something out, but I'm not changing kernel versions, when I go to install my libraries, now all of a sudden, you know, I have 2.6.10. If I go reinstall my libraries, it's going to overwrite my old ones. Yeah. I want to keep my old modules and everything, and my old kernel as a backup. You know, what do you do? Well, and they started adding a subversion number into the kernel, a kernel identification code that you can have. It's under general setup. So if you're compiling your kernel like 2.6.10 and you're compiling another one, you could put a version indication or a number on that. It could be anything you want it to be. You can call it whatever you want. Generally, I stick with like a dash and a number. Okay, so it would be, for instance, today I compiled 2.6.11.10 twice, you know, two different, one was a test version.
Just
so,
once wasn't good enough.
Yeah, because once wasn't good enough. So what I did was I just went in and under that version indication number, I put a dash 10.2, which means that's my second version. So what's neat about that is when you go to install your modules, it no longer overwrites the existing modules that are there or adds to them. What it does is now the modules directory is
separate.
Yeah, the same kernel number, the same, you know, like 2.6.10.11-2 now. or whatever I put in there for the version number. So that's really good. That's nice. Be aware of that when you're doing that. Some people might not have been aware of that. I just noticed it a couple months ago when I was playing around with it. All right. So now you got your modules installed. The next, all you have to do is just put the kernel in the system map that's created after you run make modules install. And I usually take my .config file and put it in my boot directory. I name them, you know, something logical after the name of the version of the kernel, and set up my bootloader, either Lilo or Grub. In Slackware, it's been Lilo. On Debian, I've been using Grub. I like Grub.
Grub's actually nice.
Liking that more than I liked Lilo. So there you go. That was the easy thing. Now, what happens if you want to create a strictly modular kernel, or you don't compile something that's critical into your kernel? For instance, Riser file system support. You have your root partition on a Riser file system, and you don't compile in Riser file system support. Yeah, that is a big problem, okay? So your kernel, when it goes to boot, it's not going to be able to find your root partition because it's on a Riser and it doesn't have Riser file system support. So, whoa, you know, there's a good reason.
Sounds like the voice of experience there, Dan.
Well, no,
I've done the same thing.
I want to talk a little more. I had problems a couple months ago when I first got this new machine after I compiled my own kernel because I didn't include the chipset support from the motherboard in there. It was as a module. I compiled as a module and instead of compiling it in the kernel, and the damn thing would not boot. So
imagine that.
Yeah, how about that? Lesson learned. First thing you got to make sure you do when you compile your kernel. What's nice is you probably have plenty of hard drive space. There's no reason to get rid of your old kernel. All right? Set up your bootloader.
That's what it's there.
It does multi-booting. Set up that bootloader to boot your old kernel and, you know, as many subsequent kernels after that as
just
you want.
Just in case.
Yes, just in case. Like right now, I got lazy. I got 6 different kernels that I could boot into, even though I'm only using them. Right. I'm going to eventually clean them out. But that's just, you know, just to be safe. Keep your old kernel, your libraries and everything. If you try to boot your new kernel, it doesn't work, you can at least go back. One of the nice things about Grub, as opposed to Lilo, is you could actually edit the Grub configuration right there on the bootloader screen. For instance, today I wanted to get some Visa frame buffer support going. I wanted just more than the standard 640 by 480 console that comes up, and I wanted that little penguin boot logo that comes up in there.
VGA 791.
Yeah, that's it. I use 783. Is what I've been using. But those are esoteric numbers, man. I don't know where the hell they came up
with
those
numbers. But Grub is nice. You can pass boot parameters.
You can actually edit your Grub config file. So anyway, what I did was, when I compiled my kernel, is I compiled Visa Frame Buffer support as a module. And I compiled, you know, the boot splash and everything else. But the Visa Frame Buffer support is what I absolutely needed if I'm going to pass the VGA equals parameter during the boot. So, not having that in the kernel, but as a loadable module, what would happen when it would try and load that kernel that I had, that try to boot that kernel with the VGA equals 783, all it would get would be a blank screen because the Visa Frame Buffer module could not load at the time when the kernel booted up. Now, that's a problem. And the same thing would happen if you had Riser file system support not compiled in your kernel, but it was your root partition. You would get to the point where it tries to mount the root partition and couldn't. So it can't get the modules off the root partition. Same thing with my motherboard chipset support. So you want to compile that stuff in, but if you're not going to do that, there is a way around it, and that's creating the initialization RAM disk. And what that basically does, to make initrd utilities, particularly in Debian. Slackware, I don't think, has that utility, and I'm not sure if you can get it off of linuxpackages.net. You'd have to compile it yourself. Anyway, what an initialization RAM disk will do for you is you can take those specific modules that you would need to boot, and it would preload them right after it boots the kernel so that it won't have to look for them on the root file system. If you can't get that far or be able to load those modules, because at that point your root file system is not loaded. For me, it couldn't set the display properly. It tried to, but because Visa Frame Buffer support was not in the kernel, it was as a module. It couldn't load the module at that point when it needed it. If you use the initRD, it will be able to take just those modules that you need and pull them into your kernel. So you definitely want to take a look at some of the documentation if you're going to go down that route. So realistically speaking, if you compile that important stuff into your kernel, you're not going to have that problem. So based upon that knowledge, why would you use an initRD? Why would you make an initRD? Well, again, if you're a distribution, you might want to keep the kernel as slim as possible. Make everything as a module so that it only loads what it actually needs to load. You can put those modules for the majority of system SCSI controllers, stuff like that, into the initRD, initialization RAM disk, so that it would pull those out at load time and only take what it needs. And then when it comes time to it actually mount your root partition, it'll reload all the other drivers off the root partition from your current module set that it needs. So if you're building a distribution, if you're working with embedded devices, there's another reason to use maybe a initialization RAM disk so that you can keep everything slim in the kernel and just load exactly what you need to load off of the until you'll be able to load the root partition. If you're creating a floppy disk-based boot disk, you might want to use that because, again, the more stuff you compile into the kernel, the larger it's going to be. It might not fit on a floppy disk. That way you put the kernel, a very slim kernel, on the floppy disk and the initialization RAM disk on another disk, and it'll be able to load those modules before it has to load in the root file, root partition. So that's why you would want to use an initRD, some things. Now, there's a debate. You can look at some of the stuff that I pulled together on that, whether you want to create an initRD or not. But for me today, I tried that out. Like I said, I compiled my kernel with VESA frame buffer support in. I had no problem booting with that VGA set to 783. Without it compiled in as a module, it wouldn't load. I had to create an initialization RAM disk with that module, the VESA frame buffer module, in there for it to load when it wasn't compiled into the kernel. Perfect example. And it's not that hard to do. Read the frickin' documentation. Pretty easy. Any questions that you guys might have?
InitRD, I know for Fedora, you know, a lot of times they have pre-compiled kernels that people pull down. They don't want to compile themselves. You need InitRD.
Right. When you're talking about the distributions...
In other words, they have their own package for whatever kernel version.
Right, Fedora would have an initRD. Mm-hmm. And again, chances are, like the Fedora, when they package the kernel, they put it out there, most of the stuff is in there as a module, not compiled into the kernel. You would need that initialization RAM disk in case there's something that's not in the kernel that's needed. It would, generally speaking, you don't compile every single kernel module into an initRD. Like, for instance, you wouldn't want sound drivers in there because there's no reason to necessarily put sound drivers. You're not going to need the sound drivers.
You don't need them that early. Yeah.
Right.
It's just the real raw hardware stuff you need to get your system going.
Right. So just the basic core level stuff. You might say, well, why not compile that in there to begin with? Again.
It's choice.
It is choice. You want to create a slimmer kernel, as slim as possible, so that's usable by everybody without having any unnecessary stuff in there. You go with the module thing. And then create the initialization RAM disk. Distribution choice. The Slackware doesn't use initRD. Do they? Do they use initRD, Link?
Yes.
They do?
Yep.
So,
sure.
Okay, because I could take a double check on my system because I do leave my old Lilo comp. The original Slackware kernel is probably still in there. That being said, I'm pretty much done with the kernel, and I could roll right into package management and roll on your own.
Dan, I learned everything about kernel compiling from you.
Well, no, I didn't go into specifics actually how you get down there and do it. Read some of the documentation. There's a whole lot of stuff I put up there.
I'm being serious, though. First time I compiled the kernel is when we did it with the lug. I remember we had a... I think that was... I don't know if it was over Jen's or someone's house we went to. It was the very first time I compiled.
That was one of the meetings.
Was it a meeting?
It was a meeting, yeah.
It was a while back.
And, you know, the whole module versus compiling to the kernel, from my experience, some stuff that I will always leave out as a module is sound drivers, particularly ALSA sound drivers, because I've had problems when I compile ALSA sound drivers into the kernel. They seem to work better as a module. And I know Link hates ALSA, He hates that. He's like, what is it you always say, Lex? Why load 50 modules to do what two modules used to do in the old OSS?
You're
going to
get the old OSS.
Yeah,
driver.
Open source, open sound system.
That's no shit, though, man. That's exactly what happens. OSS, you can get sound working with like one driver, two drivers, and also you have to load four. Like 25. So, no, you need like 20. Seriously, you need like 25 of them, man. It's crazy.
Also, is one of your pet peeves, right? Cups, salsa.
Yes, cups sucks, too.
Now, Slackware 10.1 uses also by default and compiled out OSS.
By default too.
Now, it compiled out OS. It didn't provide OSS support in the kernel. You had to go back in and compile that yourself, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Because you ended up, you had a problem with the AC. You got one of those funky AC97 codec.
Sound card.
Yeah, I've got the same one.
That would not work also.
Right? You end up having to buy a new card. It's just the easier way.
Piece of crap, on or off?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Dan and I spent like 3 hours trying to get sound working on my computer. The best I could get after, you know, compiling kernels and everything else was just to get the sound would either be on full blast or off.
Works for
me. You know, there was no volume control. So I said, piss on it, and I stuck in a sound blaster 16 plug and play or something like that. But I am running also now. Just because it was easier.
So now, you know,
I was frustrated, so, you know.
One of the things that you might learn, okay, is if you, and we had this experience a couple weeks ago, remember, Link, with the Linux WLAN NG drivers? If you get a certain version of a kernel, like 2.6, I think it was 8 we were working with at the time, and I tried to get the Prism 2 USB driver to work in the 2.6.8 off the Linux, that would not work at all. All right. Mm-hmm. We started downgrade. We went all the way up to the latest version, started downgrading. It wasn't until we went back to the 2.4.2.9 kernel, I think it was, that we actually got it to work. So sometimes you might have to actually go backwards to get something.
Why does it have to be like that? It should be so much more simpler, you know.
I don't know.
I mean, we're fairly knowledgeable and experienced with Linux. I mean, imagine somebody who doesn't have a freaking clue trying to get this stuff to work.
Yeah, but you know what? The deal is? You can get it to work on a later kernel if you don't use the WLAN NG drivers, but that pretty much means that you can't do WEP. You know, if you're just doing a straight shot and plugging in, unless you're using USB. If you're using USB, you got to do that WLAN NG because, as far as I know, that's the only way you can get USB to work is with that WLAN NG driver.
I think
you get it to work without that, Dan?
I have not been able to get it to work. The Prism 2 USB for the DWL-122 card, I have not been able to get it to work without the Linux WLAN NG.
With the regular drivers, you got to use that WLAN NG.
And the thing is, you know, once you get it to work, of course, the next thing you want to do is war driving, right? Kismet, exactly. I think you need the WLAN NG drivers for Prism.
Did you guys see that link that I posted?
Yeah, I did. That
it's this show. What's it called? From what the heck was the name of it? From Beyond or something like
from
that?
From the Shadows.
From the Shadows. It's this web show that these guys put together. It's a couple of guys from the old Screensavers plus, you know, some other people. And one of the segments they did was a guy showed how easy it is to crack WEP, and he basically cracked WEP within like 10, 15 minutes, no problem.
Now, the only thing...
There's a website, WAPIX.
WAPIX.
Which is a live distro.
WAPIX.
I'll put the address up on the board. They build themselves of a standalone penetration testing live CD.
For testing, right.
On it. But there's also a... and I dug this up off of Hackaday, I think it was. On it, where it's a little, I don't know if it's a flash documentation or something, but it shows how to actually use it to crack a web password in like 10 minutes.
Well, right. My link for the show, I also put the original article. The guy who did the segment was from Tom's Hardware, I think it was, and he did a couple of write-ups, and if you look in the forum, you'll see the links in there.
Now, see, what I've heard is that there's following basically the same procedure that he did. He was pulling packets in or sniffing packets that was coming from a machine that was already authenticated to it.
Exactly.
Now, there's another way to speed that up where you might be able to do it with the same machine, or you might need a second one where you just have the second machine, even though it's not authenticated through the WEP key to that machine. You just have it hitting that base station, the base station that it's going to, and it produces the necessary files to be able to crack the WEP key based upon what it's hitting, even though it doesn't know it. But you do a man-in-the-middle type attack, and you spoof the hardware address, and you just start hitting the base station, even though you can't actually use it. You hit it with the right kind of packets with that ISV code, I think it was.
Yeah, the way he did it
in
was...
there, and you would generate, like, thousands of packets a lot faster than he did.
He first figured out the MAC address, and then once he had the MAC address, he captured, I think it was 50,000 packets. And once he had the 50,000, he ran the program to run with the algorithm, and for the most part, that generated the keys for the WEP. Sometimes, if a couple instances where he was doing it, he needed more, like 100,000.
Right. But you can generate, like I said, doing this other attack, you can generate.
The WAPIX will do all that for you.
Yeah, you generate it a lot faster than the way he was doing it.
It just listens, and you gather up about 10 minutes worth of info or so. And
so basically, WEP is shit, basically. It's pretty useless.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a deterrent because, I mean, really, with all the open wireless access points out there today, WEP is a minor deterrent. I mean, if you're driving down the road and I stop in front of Link's house and I try and connect and he's got WEP enabled, you know, and I can just go right down the road, a couple houses away and I'm on, you know, I might go that far. But if I really want to get into Link's, you know, WEP enabled access point, then it's not that difficult.
The other encryption is WPA. Is that a little more secure?
Yeah, it is.
That's what I have set up on my wireless setup.
I don't have more secure. Yeah, I don't have support for that on my base station. Oh no, Linksys, which stinks.
You had an old one, huh?
Yeah.
The new one supported. See if you can get a firmware upgrade.
I did. I upgraded the firmware. That's a little more difficult to do it on the Linux side than it is on the Windows.
Well, you can do it
really
with a bootable.
Easy. Right.
They have Windows bootables that you can use just to upgrade.
I did it on the Linux. It wasn't that hard to do, but the upgrade didn't provide. It's a version 3, not a version 4. Version 4 has WPA, but version 3 doesn't of the station that I have.
One of the cool things also on that show was they were doing war driving. They were picking up X10 security cameras. And you'd be amazed what the stuff they saw. You should check out the show if you haven't already. It's pretty cool.
It's on the forum.
Yep.
All right, package management. If you're using a distribution with package management utilities, and we're talking about Debian packages, RPMs, and, you know, to an extent, Slackware, too. Package management systems can be a godsend, or they could be something that you want to tear your hair out over. That's one of the main reasons I left Red Hat a long time ago, back in version 7, was RPM hell. And they're just, I from what I hear a lot of sources saying, they're just cleaning up all the problems with RPM now, just getting into doing that. It's still not resolved. It's still a major headache. But Debian has it together a lot better than
anybody else.
Right. Now, Slackware, you do have a package management system, Slackware packages. There's no dependency checking. So you lose a lot. You lose both some of the benefits of dependency checking. For instance, with apt-get, it would go out and pull down the dependencies and make sure that if you had something that would conflict, it wouldn't let you install it. You'd have to remove a conflicting package for a newer package, so long as that didn't cause any other problems. So dependency can be good, but on the flip side, where dependencies can be hell, RPM is the case. Another reason dependencies can be hell is if you try and get a piece of software that there isn't any Debian package for. Or, for instance, this past week, I wanted to get transcode. Okay, I found a repository that would allow me to get transcode for Debian. So I started to install it. And even though all the necessary dependencies were there, somehow in the package he created, the libac codec package had a name mismatch. It was even off of his repository, but it had a name mismatch. It would not let me install transcode.
Pretty frustrating.
Hey, it can be very frustrating. Now, the question is, do I force the install and chance having a broken transcode package or some problems with regards to that, particularly if I wanted to build something off of transcode or use like MJPEG tools or whatever in conjunction with that, is that going to cause a problem down the line?
Roll your own.
Right. Or am I going to roll my own? Now, you say, oh, roll on your own. That's pretty easy. Coming from Slackware, pretty much that's what we did.
Roll your own.
You rolled just about everything that wasn't included.
Test the papers.
Yeah. Before LinuxPackages.net got really, you know, big, you would have to roll your own for mostly everything. And again, still, like, you might also want to roll your own even though you have a package manager, for instance, for, like, MPlayer. All right? You want to get
well, the codecs.
Codecs that aren't supported in your distribution. For instance, Theora support, the version that you get from your distribution may not have Theora support. So you'd have to roll your own MPlayer. It's not that hard. Okay, but what you end up having a problem with after you start rolling your own is now you've deviated from that package management system. So later on down the line,
you check install.
Right. Well, I'm getting, dude. You read my notes.
No, didn't you?
No, we're getting that. So now you have a problem. You're like saying, okay, I have compiled all the necessary codecs by hand, libraries, video libraries, and everything. LibQuickTime. I have all that support. MP4 support and everything I compiled, but now I want to get a package, let's say, I don't know, a video player, video LAN client from Debian, and it says, well, in order for me to install this, I have to install all these other codecs, but I already installed those, but my system doesn't know, my package management system doesn't know that
doesn't
I already have
it.
Them installed, because I did that by hand, outside the package management system. So now it's like, oh, or another thing might be, is if you want a more recent version, for instance, Inkscape, that came, that I had a choice. I can use the Inkscape version that came with, was available through Fink for OS X, which was a couple versions behind, or I can try and compile the latest version of Inkscape because it had a feature I wanted, which is putting text on a path. So at that point, I can compile Inkscape and drop it down onto my system. But now, when the version of Inkscape through Fink gets to be the same version
yours.
As mine, maybe I want to use the Fink package. Maybe they got some stuff in there that I didn't compile. Maybe it'll work a little better. Now I have the reverse problem. I install that package, and I have my old package over there. So generally speaking, okay, packages for your distribution. When you install a package, it's going to go in one of two places. It's either going to go in the USR directory, or it might go into the op directory, or USR X11. That might be a third option. But any packages that you yourself install, okay, should go into USR local. So anything that you install, if you keep it under USR local, you're all right. But then the problem comes if you install a large package like transcode, and so it's going to dump files into bin, possibly sbin. It's going to jump libraries, shared files, and everything. It might be a little difficult to pull all those files out.
Because of all the different applications that need it.
Right. But it might be difficult to go in there
just,
if you
just
wanted
to find
remove
where
it.
Everything is.
Right. Now, there's two things that you could do. You can keep your package sources around, and if your package, if the developer was kind enough to provide a make uninstall, you run a make uninstall, it'll move all those stuff out.
But there's okay. No guarantee of that.
No, there isn't. There's no guarantee of that. If that feature is not the make uninstall, so you have to try and uninstall it yourself. The second thing is you don't have to keep the source around if it has a make install. You could just go through the process of recompiling it again, and then instead of make install, you just run make uninstall. It'll pull it all out. All right. So the problem with rolling your own, two things. You deviate from the dependency checking support that you have on your package manager, and it might be difficult to uninstall some packages. So you can take the middle ground here. You can use a wonderful utility called check install.
Yes, we all know check install.
Check install. Check install does Slackware packages, does Debian packages, does RPMs.
Yep.
Now, it's a wonderful utility, but I only recommend using this for personal use. Or maybe if you want to, you know, if you want to share with a friend who is understanding of what exactly is going to happen here. Okay, check install does a great job, but what it doesn't do is dependency. All right? So you put together, you know, you compile a piece of software and you install it. It's going to take that, everything that installed, it's going to install it into a temporary directory, build the package off of that, and you'll be able to install with Debian's package manager where you create RPM or a Slackware package. So you can install it on your systems because you should know You know, if you compiled it and it worked and everything is, you know, compiled was successful, chances are it's going to work on your system. But if I took that package and made a Debian repository for that package or gave it to Alan, he has no way of knowing whether that system
is
going to work on his system. So that's why I say check install is great, primarily for the capability of not only managing the packages that you install, but being able to uninstall them. So seriously, only use them on your own systems that you are familiar with. Now, there have been cases
guys,
when
guys, are we on BinRef tonight?
Yes, we are. We got 5 minutes.
Yeah, 2 minutes.
According to BinRef clock, we have 6 minutes.
Then we got 6 minutes.
So I am watching the clock. All right. Now, couple of the tricks that you start to learn, particularly when you use Slackware, is if you go to linuxpackages.net, you grab some Slackware packages, there is absolutely no guarantee that they're going to work. Some people put the dependencies listed in the description. Some people don't.
Most people don't.
Yeah, so you pull down a package, and you're sitting there wondering, why the hell won't it work? All right, but usually it'll say, can't find a specific library.
Yeah, I'll spit out a message.
So one of the easiest things to do is just run LDD on the binary. For instance, if it was transcode, I run LDD transcode. It's going to print out a list of all the libraries that binary was compiled against. You just look at where it says not found, not
whatever
found.
You don't have,
and you look for those packages to pull that down. That's one way to get around that. Okay, particularly on the Slackware side. You can do it on the Debian side, too. Now, aside from just using check install, there are other instances where you might have to go out and deviate from your package management system. For instance, 2 weeks ago, I wanted to get Celestia. Okay? For those who don't know, Celestia is a wonderful astronomy application which allows you to cruise through an OpenGL universe, check out different stuff like the Earth, the Sun, our whole solar system, satellites, other stars. Really cool. I've run Celestia on Slackware.
It's heavy KDE application.
It is. But it's really nice.
It is real nice.
It has this horrible dependency on LibLua. Okay? And I had such a hard time getting, I think it was LibLua, the dependency that it needed.
Some sort of Hawaiian package?
It's a library. I actually had to pull down the RPM because I couldn't get the right version that I needed on Slackware. Now, Slackware has an RPM to TGZ, which will create a Slackware package out of an RPM file. And I installed that. Now, of course, Slackware doesn't depend on dependency, but for Debian, I wanted Celestia. I'm running Sarge. There are two other applications in there that were similar to Celestia. And when I installed them, each one of those said, hey, this is not supported anymore. Install Celestia. I do an apt-get install Celestia. Can't find it.
Really?
Not available. So I do find, you know, I've managed to find, I think it was, I had an RPM of Celestia. Because they don't have the source. I couldn't find the source. I don't think I could find the source. So I used Alien to create a Debian package.
Use the source, Dan.
Right, out of the RPM. And it was no problem after that. I had to get that crazy library. There's something else I'll explain that another day. But there's another way of doing stuff. If you can't find the Debian package that you need, you might want to try Alien, which is a package conversion utility. It'll convert from RPM to Debian, and I believe to Slackware, and in between any one of those package management systems.
You just need to know what flags to pass.
Right. It's really easy. I got OpenOffice 2.0 beta using Alien. I downloaded the RPMs today, converted them all into Debian packages and installed it, and so far I haven't had a problem. There might be a better way to do it, or maybe somebody has already put those together, but, you know, it's a possibility. And again, once you start doing that, I'm not sure Alien does that heavy of a dependency tracking. You could run into issues. So it's something to be aware of. So if you're going to roll your own, I recommend, highly recommend using check install. Now, if you want to actually go even one step further and create official Debian packages or RPMs or Slackware packages, it's not really that hard to do. It's a little complicated, particularly for Debian. Slackware, it's a breeze. Okay, but for Debian, I put some links up there on the show notes for tonight on how to build those. So, easy, good to do.
Compile on.
I don't think we're going to be able to talk about recording Linux sessions with VNC utilities today. So we'll have to save that for next week. What I do want to add, though, is if you go to the show notes, there is an example, okay, for the VNC to SWS example that I have. You click on that example, it shows you
You signing homework?
Yeah, signing homework. It shows you just me pulling up a session and doing using check install to create a Debian package and installing the Debian package after that.
It's cool.
So it's a session. And the cool thing is it has actual audio with it. So I was going to talk about that. If anybody has read my my article on Linux Gazette about a year ago and creating animated screenshots on Linux, talked about adding audio. There's a new application. When you get VNC to SWF, there's a really cool Python-based application there called Edit VNC to SWS, which will allow you to stream in a MP3 file to go along with your video.
Cool. Because so, I remember you had issues, you know, with the audio.
Yeah, it was a little tricky to get that in there. It's a little easier now. There's still, you know, you got to script it out and plan it beforehand. And I'll talk about that next week, how I actually did that. So that's what I'm done talking. I am done talking. So hopefully we talked about some technical issues, gave somebody some information.
Cut the chit-chat, damn it.
Yeah, cut down on the chit-chat. No more banter. Make people happy. It would have been helpful if I actually wrote out my notes a little better instead of having a crumbled up piece of paper. Anything else from anybody else before we actually close down?
Sounds good.
No?
Nope.
Link?
Defer and save my idle banter for next week.
Yes. I guess that's it. We'll close it up.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
See you next week.
Play our log file out of here, and we'll see what happens. Have a good one, Link. Hope you have a nice weekend, if I don't see you.
You guys, too.
Take care.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Instead of shaped like a pine tree, shaped like a little...